Hello, Florida Bar members and Florida registered paralegals. This is a quick reminder from the Standing Committee on Mental Health and Wellness of Florida Lawyers that you are approved to use the Florida Lawyers Helpline, a completely free and confidential around-the-clock helpline designed to support you in managing the challenges of both your personal and professional life. By dialing 833-FL1-WELL or 833-351-9355, you can connect with mental health professionals who are ready to assist you. Take advantage of up to 5 complimentary in-person or telehealth counseling sessions annually, and remember, there's no limit to the number of calls you can make. Reach out today.
You're listening to the Florida Bar Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel. Produced by the broadcast professionals of the Florida Bar.
Welcome to the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel Podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. We are so glad you're joining us. This is Autumn Chadwell. I'm one of the hosts of the show, which is being recorded from our studio in Tallahassee, Florida. Our goal at the Practice Resource Center is to assist Florida attorneys with running the business side of their law practices. We focus on a different topic each month and carry the theme through our website with related tips, videos, and articles. Studies have shown us time and time again that working in the field of law can take a toll on your well-being. The pressure to win cases, provide for your family, impress the partners, make sure your client is satisfied, and take some time for yourself can be overwhelming. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and with depression running rampant in the field, we're going to do what many have trouble with. We're going to talk about it. Today, I am talking with Dan Lukasik about the stigma behind depression, the symptoms to watch out for, and how to take care of yourself in your practice. Dan is a lawyer, mental health advocate, law professor, and public speaker who has delivered over 250 presentations on stress, anxiety, burnout, and depression across the United States. Dan is an instructor at the New York State Judicial Institute, as well as a member and major contributor to the New York State Bar Association's Wellbeing Task Force. He is the executive producer of 3 documentaries on mental health and has created 2 websites, Lawyers with Depression and the Buffalo Depression Project, both dedicated to mental health. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you, Autumn, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We're so glad that you're here. So let's jump right into it. Dan, let's talk about depression. What are some of the causes that attorneys should be mindful of?
Well, some of them in terms of causes begin before they even set foot in law school. The biggest contributors or risk factors for adult onset depression, which is what we're talking about here, is genetics. Scientists believe that about 50% of depression and other mood disorders is related to a genetic risk factor. So what we tend to see is a family history of mood disorders. So if we look through our family tree, and it might not be your parents or siblings, it could be your grandparents, that would be some indication of a genetic risk. Number two, the other thing is a history of family dysfunction, neglect, or abuse. So what do I mean by that? So for myself, I grew up in a family with an alcoholic father, and it was a turbulent, dysfunctional home. And they know, science knows, that when you combine those two things, a family history of depression together with a dysfunctional childhood home, your risk factor for developing adult onset depression increases exponentially. Now, what happens then after people set foot in law school, the research shows that depression rates rise above that of the general population. So there's something unique that happens in law school and the training we get in law school that must contribute to that rise in depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide happening so often in law schools across the country. But then in the other aspect of it, when we enter the profession, things can develop even further. What we know in addition to genetic family history, in terms of family dysfunction. Lawyers have some unique qualities, characteristics, and workplace factors that really contribute to make it what I call the perfect storm for these high rates of depression to happen. They tend to have perfectionistic personalities. They tend to be driven by unreasonably high workplace standards, which can generate anxiety and depression. Anxiety and depression, by the way, Autumn, 50% of people with depression also have anxiety and vice versa. So they're kind of cousins that frequently travel together. So you got, these particular kind of people. They tend to be type A, they tend to be driven, they tend to be perfectionist. The other quality that people may or may not think of, there's been a lot of research by Dr. Martin Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a psychologist who wrote a great chapter in his book, Why Are Lawyers So Unhappy? And what he attributes it to is a certain kind of pessimistic explanatory style. So what that means is just kind of a outlook on the world that tends to be negative. And for lawyers, this kind of pessimistic style is usually highly adaptive. An example might be for me, if I would walk into a deposition, I would feel and scan the room for negative indicators, such as an adversary or somebody on the other side who's gruff or aggressive or nasty. You're kind of bracing yourself for that. The other way, I'd be walking into a courtroom to pick a jury, and I'd be looking at the jury pool for like smirks or sidewalk glances, or that I was boring them, or the judge was grumpy. So we have this hypervigilance and scan the environment for negative things, things that might cause trouble for ourselves or our clients. So you combine all these things, right? And it sets the stage for these stratospheric high levels of depression.
Absolutely. I love that you brought up the fact that depression and anxiety typically go hand in hand, that comorbidity there, because once you have feelings of depression, then you can start getting a little worried, and one typically does go with the other.
Yeah, well, you could say, the way I like to talk about it where I teach at the law school is that it can be depressing to be depressing, right? And it can be very anxiety provoking to be anxious. But when we talk about these concepts, what is depression? What is anxiety? Everybody feels that way at different times of their lives. That's a normal part of the human journey. What's different with depression, clinical depression, what we're talking about is a cluster of symptoms, and they're different for everyone. Some of them, one of the symptoms, for example, is sleep problems or sadness, okay? Not in of themselves abnormal or cause for concern. But what a mental health provider, and this could be your family doctor, is looking for is not only a cluster of symptoms that are associated with depression, but also impairment. Whatever you're going through, is it impairing, affecting in a negative way your professional life at the office or your home with your children or your family, or if you live alone, your friendships? And or is it affecting you at work in terms of your concentration, productivity, ability to get things done? So that is what clinical depression looks like. And most people don't. People who have never been through clinical depression often don't have a reference point to what it is. They may mix it up and say, it's sadness or it's grief or it's this or it's that. The difference being for people who've never had depression, they bounce back, right? And it doesn't go on for a long time. Depression can go on for months or years. Typically, if we experience everyday moods or depression or anxiety or stress, that doesn't go on for years or months, and it's not typically disabling or impairing. So that's a very thumbnail sketch of the difference between stress and anxiety or everyday anxiety and clinical anxiety, being depressed once in a while and clinical depression.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about whenever you brought up impairment, that is such a big part of it, because in at least the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, that's one of the biggest factors about it is that it has to impair your daily life. It has to be affecting you in that day to day. So feeling that more often is definitely a really big part of it. And then you mentioned sadness. And I know a lot of people can use those terms interchangeably, depression and sadness. What can you tell us what the difference there is?
Yeah, sadness for most people, not necessarily, but sadness is one, could be one of the symptoms associated with depression, chronic sadness. It certainly was for me. But you have to have these other two qualities of it going on for too long, weeks, months, years. And the other point is impairment. Sadness is a normal human emotion, right? Everybody in life experiences sadness. Not everybody in life experiences clinical depression. Clinical, you know, sadness is an emotion. Clinical depression is a disease, an illness. So there's a lot of ways to distinguish them, but they often get, you know, mushed together in the way we talk about these conditions. Impairment should be a huge topic of interest for law firms in particular, because I believe it's 75% of all disciplinary and grievance claims are due to depression and or alcohol, and sometimes frequently in combination. So we think of it this way, how I think about it. Depression affects the human brain. It affects your ability to concentrate, to think, often to sleep. You are going to have a great deal of difficulty being productive and effective as a lawyer in that regard. So impairment as a DSM or medical term carries over to impairment and what that means in the legal profession in terms of competency, the ability to do your job. So law firms, lawyers have to be concerned about this, not only from the vantage point of productivity and the ability to get things done, but also concern of its possible effects on the firm's bottom line. Think of billable hours or its effect on clients. You know, there, you know, an attorney's ability to be a zealous advocate and do a good job. So there's lots of implications.
Now, you mentioned sadness and impairment, and then before you did also mention sleep problems. Can you tell us about any other signs or symptoms of depression that our lawyers should be on the lookout for?
Sure, a few of them, and there's nine symptoms. A couple other ones are basically they're focused on changes. So changing in eating habits, eating too little or too much, sleeping too little or too much, suicidal ideation, not actually attempting suicide, but thinking about suicide, difficulty concentrating. These are known symptoms associated with depression. However, I have to stress that they themselves alone are not cause for a diagnosis of depression. And I have to warn people about self-diagnosing. You know, I, as an undergraduate, I had a degree in psychology. I went to law school. I think I was basically pretty knowledgeable about, okay, you know, depression, you know. But here I was at age 40, managing partner of my law firm, and I was struck by a depression and ultimately diagnosed with it. And I didn't think I had major depression. I thought it was maybe burnout. I was working too much. Who knows? Or I thought maybe, gee, maybe I shouldn't be a lawyer anymore. Maybe this is, you know, my job is not good for me. But it wasn't those things. And when I was 40, I was diagnosed with major depression, which was a very difficult chapter in my life. Now, looking back on it 25 years later.
Absolutely. And self-diagnosis is such a big thing these days because everybody's on WebMD, putting in their symptoms, Googling everything that's going on. And it can be difficult to really know if you're self-diagnosing yourself with the right thing.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that's a great point, Autumn, because with diagnosis becomes maybe connected to that are strategies that might be effective or productive or get you better, right? So if you self-diagnose wrong, that can lead you in the wrong direction in terms of what strategies and things might be helpful. So I think that I highly recommend seeing a mental health provider. Some people, you know, might be disinclined for stigma reasons not to see a psychiatrist. And I tell them, you know, 90% of the antidepressants in the United States are written by family providers, you know, physician's assistants or doctors and, you know, your primary doctor are trained in how to evaluate and assess and diagnose depression. So you can go there, and that's a good first step.
I love that you brought up the stigma. That's a perfect segue into the next question. Now that we know what depression is, let's talk about why it's hard to talk about. Why do you feel there's such a stigma related to attorneys specifically with depression, and do you think it's gotten any better over the years?
Well, let's talk about it two ways. Let's unpack it two ways. Let's talk about it individually and why it's so hard for lawyers to talk about it. I think because a part of our workplace culture, part of our training as lawyers is to be winners, to be independent thinkers, to be tough, to not complain. You know, we're hired to solve other people's problems, not have, you know, problems ourselves. And I think that there's a great deal of concern and fear and anxiety when someone is, you know, going through this journey of depression and fearing what's going to happen to me at work if they find out, what's going to happen to me if I show any signs or talk about this. There could be real world implications for that. And so a lot of people fear that and they don't talk about it and often don't get help. They wait to the, you know, I've seen this hundreds of times across the US where people wait to the wheel to fall off. I certainly did. And it got to the point where I had to take a year leave of absence to get treatment and get better. Thankfully, I was a partner, so I had a great private disability policy. But, you know, this discussion about has stigma gotten better? The simple answer, qualified, is yes. So I'm looking at it from over a 25-year perspective from when I was first diagnosed to today. In the general culture at large, you know, there's been a great deal of progress and movement and open dialogue about the topic of depression and certainly other mental health disorders. That's good, right? Because we're now beginning to recognize, gee, not only does this an individual problem, but it affects all aspects of one's life and other people's lives. Let's think of law firms. And I just talked about how it's a direct impact. The bottom line of law firms. So that's a significant thing. But what we see is an easing of depression, especially more recently, I would say in the last 10 years. 2017 was the National Task Force report and recommendations, which was based on two studies conducted in 2016. Of about one study was for law students, about 3,300 law students. The other was based on a confidential survey of 13,000 lawyers from across the country. And what they found were disturbing, elevated, high risk, high numbers for not only law students, but lawyers when it comes to anxiety, depression, problematic drinking, and suicidal ideation. So the recommendations that were going back almost 10 years were kind of the trumpet blast saying, this can't go on. This is a serious problem that we have as a profession. So it's not seen just as an individual problem anymore, which it used to be. This is seen as a cultural, a workplace cultural, professional cultural problem in the law. So 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you would never even have had a discussion like you and I are having now. You would never have CLE programs at law firms talking about these thorny mental health topics. They'd just be shoved under the carpet. But now it's happening throughout the U.S. Certainly, it's not perfect. Certainly not all law firms are doing this. But I think there's a real sobering recognition from all levels of the profession, bar associations, law regulators, law schools that, okay, we got to do something about it. No denying anymore. It's a big problem. What are some effective steps?
Absolutely. So in your opinion, at what point does an attorney decide, okay, I cannot fix this on my own. I need to ask somebody for help.
You know, and I think this is so common, is that it's a difficult question to answer because everybody's so different, right? Some of this is generational. For example, you know, I often make a dividing line between those 40 and younger and 40 and older. The reason being because people who are older grew up in a very different culture where there was heavy stigma, right? No talk about this at all. You know, that was certainly true for me. So a lot of managing partners are of that generation, okay? Younger people under 40 or people in law school who are associates, they are much more open to talking about this amongst themselves, clearly, and seeking help to address this. So I think what we're doing is, it depends on which population you're talking about. Older lawyers, senior management are less inclined, or more, you could say, experience stigma at higher levels than people who are younger, who are more apt to get help, to get support from their friends. I guest lectured at Harvard and Yale on this topic. And I experienced this in my class I teach at the University of Buffalo Law School on mental health and law. So some of it is generational. Some of it is also related to law firm culture. Okay. Some firms, you know, they could be small and mid-sized, but also large firms are doing things to create a healthy, supportive workplace culture when it comes to mental health. And that certainly increases the possibility or likelihood that an attorney would seek help for a mental health or an alcohol abuse problem.
Okay, so let's say that somebody is having difficulties, but they're not wanting to ask for help because of the stigma and because of these issues. What would you say are the consequences of not getting that help?
Well, there's a lot of research on this topic in the general population, and it's an important issue. So what are the consequences of not getting help? There's a lot, right? In terms of the science of depression, they know that the further this depression goes on without any kind of help and intervention, the sicker you become. Most people, not everybody, but most people don't spontaneously, recover from depression on their own. So it tends to get worse, right, when you don't address it. And the more often you have depression episodes, the more often you're likely to have them into the future. So they also know that earlier in the process, you know, the earlier you are when you start experiencing these things, the better it will be for you in the long term. What I see is that when things are not dealt with, what do you see? Certainly in the law firm context, we find people being let go. Being fired as attorneys because they can't keep up, they can't concentrate and be productive. So they're really concrete, results from that, not dealing with it. And then separate and apart from that, I think in the legal community, you see grievance matters, against lawyers. And they're not being grieved, of course, for the depression, but they're being grieved because of the symptoms that happen from depression, such as always being tired, not calling back clients, not filing things when they should be. So there are some real world consequences. And the private way, you know, people get divorced over this. Children, families are greatly impacted by untreated depression and mood disorders. Frequently, you know, there seems to be a division in how depression can be expressed when it comes down to men versus women. Women, this is not a generalization, it is a generalization, I guess, but women tend to be more expressive with their emotions, and they tend to seek out support more often than men. Men tend to keep it inside, and a common expression of depression for men isn't so much being emotional or tearful or seeking out friendships, but being isolated and irritable and angry. Okay, that's a culturally acceptable way for men traditionally to express emotions, not sadness, but, you know, it comes out as irritation or anger. There's also a big difference when it comes to suicide between men and women. Most people, the vast, vast, vast majority of people struggling with depression, of course, don't commit or die by suicide. However, of the people that die from suicide, 80% of them are dealing with depression.
Let's go back to seeking out support. So I've listened to a few different podcasts and talks that you've given, and in each one, you talk about the overwhelming loneliness that can come with fighting depression. How important is it to have a support system?
I really believe it's crucial because, why is the experience of depression a lonely experience? So sometimes we throw around the term stigma. Okay. I think it's important to note that stigma can come from the outside, clearly, people saying things, people avoiding you, or people saying mean things. But stigma can come from the inside. And that was certainly true for me, where you feel an overwhelming sense of shame that you're a failure, that you're a loser, that why can't I cut it as a lawyer? Why can't I get things done? There's kind of a self-accusation that comes along with it. So I think, that's two pieces of the puzzle, this coming from the outside and coming from the inside. And, the other thing that's interesting, Autumn, about stigma, when we talk about stigma, is that I find, especially in the last 5-6 years that I've been working full time as the wellness coordinator for the New York State court system, and just speaking at CLEs around the country, at law firms and conferences, is that the stigma in terms of people belittling people or isolating people has gone down. I don't want to characterize it as a ton, but quite a bit. So what I find now is not so much people, shaming other people, but people remaining silent. Why is that? Because they don't know what to say. Lots of times people say, Dan, I want to help my colleague who has depression or my adult son or daughter, but I feel paralyzed by not knowing what to say. So I say nothing. So what I say to them is, listen, the result is the same, right? So, when someone is stigmatized, shamed, they're silenced, right? So the result is people feel a disconnection with everyone else, and that can be very lonely. So let's contrast that with people who are, want to help but don't know what to say and don't say anything. The result is the same, and people feel disconnected, alone, and lonely. So I think going forward in our society and in the legal profession, I think that we need to address those two aspects of stigma and educate people. One of the things I do is I teach a class, a CLE class or a program on how management can support and help somebody with depression. Because in the workplace, what do you say to someone with depression? How do you broach the topic? I often say, if you're thinking about talking to an attorney, are you the best person to talk to them? Maybe you're not. Right. There are things that are helpful to say. We want to listen a lot. There are things that are not helpful to say, like, I'm depressed too. And, don't you think you got to get over this or take a vacation? We don't get this kind of training, certainly in our college careers or in law school. So, people need to be trained for that. There's lots of ways to get that training. Certainly, lawyers assistance programs, which are every state, such as Florida, has a statewide lawyers assistance program. And it's there to help lawyers with all these kind of mental health and substance abuse problems. They're also there not only to help individual lawyers, but law firms, law firm management. We would like to get training or be educated on how we, as people who care and want to have a healthy workplace, how do we, in a concrete way, have this discussion. And then after we've had discussion, what do we do? You know, do we, after we have the discussion, is that the end of it? Not necessarily so. It might involve working with a lawyer assistance program, could be your EAP, you know, your employee assistance program, or could be a lot of other things.
Can you give us just a couple examples of some positive things that attorneys can do to help out their fellow colleagues?
Yeah, I always say, Autumn, get educated. You know, so in our world of social media and the accessibility of YouTube, you can actually go pop on a YouTube video for 15 minutes, say, right? And they'll actually have things on there about how to help somebody with depression. There's also a wonderful book called How to Help Somebody You Love with Depression. There's podcast series. There's different mental health organizations that actually provide training, such as the National Alliance for Mental Illness, the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. And I also blog on my website, which is Lawyers with Depression. I've posted different blogs about how to support somebody, how to have that talk with them. Because, you know, to be honest, nobody really did have that talk with me all those years ago until the wheel fell off. I wish people would have asked me, Dan, you know, how are you doing? You know, or, you know, I'm concerned about you. I see that you're coming in late, that your work product has suffered. Are you okay? You know, so there are ways to do this that are productive and there are ways to do it that are detrimental.
Absolutely. Now, I read an article that you have written called The Depressed Lawyer, Getting Things Done is Tough. And one of my favorite things that you talk about is mornings. Mornings are the worst. It's difficult to have that fight with yourself where you have to convince yourself to get out of bed and start your day. Can you speak about that challenge and tell our listeners the benefit of having that fight with yourself?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the important thing to recognize is as someone with depression, your brain works differently. The brain of most people who don't struggle with depression is that they feel motivated inside, you know, their brains and bodies. They feel motivated, they set goals, and then they move towards that and they're rewarded for that. Okay, there's a part of the brain that registers pleasure when we accomplish things. Well, and somebody who has a brain that's associated with depression, that isn't working. Okay, we don't feel a sense of motivation. We don't feel a sense of pleasure. So what happens oftentimes in the morning, we keep waiting to feel motivated, and then it doesn't come. It just doesn't come. And that's why it's so common for folks with depression to say, you know, I wasted the whole day or my whole morning. I wasn't able to get anything done, because that's not going to work, because the brain does not function that way when we have depression. So what they suggest, the psychologists suggest, psychiatrists and mental health professionals, is just recognizing that that's the case. Okay. And in your morning, begin doing things, and sometimes or often the motivation follows. Okay, that's very different than how most people approach their day. The other thing I do is, I think, helpful is that lawyers are terribly hard on themselves as a general matter, right? But also, you know, when they have depression. So what I do, Autumn, I talk with them, you know, about time management, and that, you know, you hear that all the time. There's software in the legal profession for those things. So I think it's more helpful and constructive for a depressed lawyer to think of it as not so much time management, but energy management. And what do I mean by that? So with depression, you know, every day is not for many people, it's not a catastrophic every day or every week or every month or every year. Depression can really wax and wane. You know, there's chronic depression, there's acute depression. So we can come in and out of these mood valleys. Okay. So what I say it's helpful to do every day is just take your temperature, your depression temperature. And a big component of that is energy. How much energy do I have today? Sometimes that because of my illness is very low. Sometimes it's, you know, about in the middle, and sometimes I feel no depression and I'm having a good productive day or week or months. Okay. But what happens, I'll give you an example. So I wake up and I still do have depression, and it's a terrible day and I feel no energy, no motivation. I look at my calendar, I look at the day ahead and I think, okay, because I'm going to have little energy, how can I set up my day to be helpful? So anything that is not necessary, anything that I have scheduled that I can adjourn or I can kick off into the future, I do that. And I don't feel guilty. I used to feel guilty about it all the time. You know, a lot of lawyers are very difficult at saying no. So there are things we can say no to. Many things in our calendar aren't deadlines, you know, within the next 8 hours of your day. So we need to reroute, our energy, conserve it, and think about, okay, today I got to take better care of myself. I still have to do my job. I still have to take care of my family, but I need to think this through, because just trying to bowl my way through it or push my way through it, it doesn't work all the time. Very infrequently it works, because it's not recognizing that the brain is impacted by these kind of things, and correspondingly so is your energy level. So I think those are two good practical things, Autumn. Number one, recognize that with depression, your brain works a little differently and you're not going to feel highly motivated in the morning. And from research statistical point of view, that is a very, very, very common complaint of depressives, where their depression's worst in the morning. That's very common. You know, so it's not some abnormal kind of thing. So recognizing that your brain works a little differently, that it's normal to feel that way, and to start doing things, even if you don't feel motivated, and some motivation will follow, I think is a very good thing. And then thinking in terms of energy management rather than time management, or in conjunction with time management. Taking into account how much energy you have daily, weekly is a good thing.
Absolutely. And Dan, I can't thank you enough for having this conversation with me. Your vulnerability and openness with such a difficult topic is so incredibly inspiring. And I know that anybody listening who is having trouble is likely feeling at least a little bit better knowing that they're not alone. So with that being said, if there is an attorney listening to this podcast who is struggling with depression, what would you like to say to them?
Well, I think what I would like to say, and I learned this through the School of Hard Knocks, both as a lawyer, a managing partner, a litigator, all those things, that really the twin pillars of depression are a sense of helplessness and hopelessness, right? You feel incapable of digging yourself out from this sense of depression. And because of that, you feel a sense of hopelessness about the future. Things are terrible today. They're going to be terrible tomorrow. They're going to be terrible next week. And that just fuels this vicious circle of depression. That's why it's so hard to get unstuck. But I think that the thing to remember, and I say this having lived with depression myself a long time, but getting to know thousands of lawyers over the last 25 years, law students, judges, that things can get better. And a psychologist once said something really brilliant to me, Autumn. He goes, depression is not your fault, but it is your responsibility to get better. There's no way around that. Okay, there's just no way around it. And that's a tough truth. So, but when we take some ownership over that, guess what happens? We feel more empowered. We feel we can help ourselves. And when we do that, we feel more hopeful. Depression is very disempowering, because of those twin pillars of helplessness and hopelessness. When we take some control, right? Or maybe a lot of control, we feel empowered with, and it makes us see that we can help ourselves, and we gain more confidence and can make us more hopeful about the future. That is certainly one of the lessons of my 25-year journey with depression. And I think, take a first step. So your first step might be, you know, making an appointment with your family physician and just telling them your symptoms and seeing if this is the case. It might be reaching out to a lawyer's assistance program, which is free and confidential. Every state has one, and explain what's going on. It might be joining a support group. So there's lots of things that can be done to give you that sense of, you know, agency and hopefulness. And you can do it. You know, you can do it.
It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. I love that. That is fantastic. It just reminds you that you need to take care of yourself.
There's no other, you know, yes. And then when we do, you don't have to do it all yourself, because what will happen, you'll gain allies. A good therapist is a good ally, right? A support group is a circle of allies. A good person to prescribe antidepressants is a good ally. So you don't have to do it all yourself. I think the point is you're part of the solution. You know, you can't be, people cannot walk the walk for you. You have to, in some measure, even when it's tough, and I'm not Pollyannish and saying this is easy, but what you have to do in trying to get up from the ground, which depression will push you down to, is take the first step. And the first step could be something as simple as talking to your family physician, reaching out to LEP, talking to a friend. For some people who are religious, it could be talking to your priest or a rabbi or an imam, who often talk to people with this condition. So it's taking the first step. And I can tell you it's so worth it and impactful to take that first step.
Beautifully said. Well, it looks like we have reached the end of our program. Thank you so much, Dan, for joining us today.
Thank you, Autumn, and thank you to the Florida Bar for having me as a guest.
Absolutely. If you are struggling with feelings of depression, anxiety, hopelessness, or suicidal thoughts, and you're not sure who to turn to, please contact the Florida Lawyers Helpline at 833-351-9355 to talk to someone. Other resources are included in our show notes. If you like what you heard today, please rate us in Apple Podcasts and join us next time for another episode of the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel Podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. I'm Autumn Chadwell. Until next time, thank you for listening.
If you'd like more information about today's show, please visit legalfuel.com. Don't miss an episode by subscribing to the Florida Bar's podcast via iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and RSS. Find the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, the Florida Bar. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.
Are you looking to grow your practice? Consider joining the Florida Bar's Lawyer Referral Service. There's never been a better time to apply because we are currently waiving the $125 annual fee, so members who qualify can join the Florida Bar LRS for free. All panel members of the Florida Bar Lawyer Referral Service must be licensed in Florida, must be members in good standing, and must carry a minimum of $100,000 in professional liability insurance to participate. Panel members must also maintain an office physically located in one of the 52 Florida counties served by the Florida Bar Lawyer Referral Service. For more information and to apply, please go to floridabar.org/LRS.